Welcome, everyone. This is Daisha from the Science Media Center. I'd like to welcome you to our briefing on an important piece of research that's being published tomorrow in the journal Nature. We are fortunate to have the lead author of that paper here with us. To give you just a little bit of background on it, the information he'll be covering is looking at the tsunami that occurred in September 2009, causing close to 200 deaths in the wake of that in Samoa and Tonga. John's research and his team at GNS Science have been puzzling over the data, the seismic data and the tsunami wave data, immediately following trying to explain why the information they had back didn't match predictions for what should have occurred. And they have found, as John will walk you through, that this seems to have been caused by a rare occurrence of a double earthquake, two earthquakes following near simultaneously upon each other. So I will hand over now to Dr. John Bevan. And John, can you take us through your slides?
Okay, thanks, Daisha. I'll just click onto the first one. This is just an introduction. So as Daisha says, I'm going to run you through how we discovered the fact that there was a double earthquake, not just a single earthquake, that caused the earthquake and the tsunami last September. And in fact, it's not just our paper that's being published in Nature tomorrow, but there's another paper on the same earthquakes by a group of American, mostly American seismologists. And they use completely different techniques from us, but come up with basically exactly the same story. So anyway, I'll go through the slides now. We've got a group here. My work, as was on the introductory page, is in ground deformation using GPS. Xiaoming and Gaga and William are all tsunami modelers. Caroline is a seismologist. Kate Wilson, a geologist, and we are all at GNS Science. Mike Beavis is at Ohio State University in the U.S., and he's a colleague who's been working with us measuring deformation of the Southwest Pacific Islands for many years. And Richard Kautoke is with the Ministry of Land Survey, Natural Resources and Environment in Tonga, and he collected some of the critical data that we use in interpreting this event. So the initial data from the event, from any big earthquake like this, is seismic waves, which go out and are collected around the world, and usually very quickly after an event, the event is located, and not long after that, the style of the earthquake is determined. And this yellow and white beach ball in the middle of this image is showing the location of the earthquake, and the fact that it's got white in the middle and yellow on the sides is telling us that it's a normal fault event, which means it's an extensional event. The two sides of the fault that break are pulling apart from each other. And the location of this event was to the east of the Tonga Trench, and the event was extensional, and so you can see up in the upper left corner the exact location of the event, and that told basically seismologists and other earth scientists around the world that this is a break within the Pacific plate, where it, as it's coming in and bending down to go into the subduction zone, it goes under tension and it breaks in one of these extensional or tensional earthquakes. And so it all looked pretty routine. It was a very big normal fault event. We don't usually get them as big as that in what we call the outer rise region. It's the region where the plate is coming in before it dips down and goes under the other plate. So it was fairly rare in being so big, but it wasn't particularly unusual in that it was the style of event that we expected for the location that it occurred at. And this is just showing a cartoon of the two types of earthquake, the two typical types of earthquake that occur near a subduction boundary. The ones that usually do the most damage are ones like the one at the top, where we call it a subduction megathrust event. But so in this case, the two sides of the fault, the Pacific plate is going downwards beneath the what we called here the Fiji Lau microplate, but it's also called the Tonga microplate. It's just another very small tectonic plate. The Pacific plate is going downwards. Typically, often in these events, the two sides of the boundary stay stuck together for a long period of time and then fail in a big earthquake. And so these arrows are showing the direction of motion. The yellow arrows are showing the direction of motion in the earthquake. So this is a typical subduction underthrust event. And the event in the earthquake in Chile in February this year was an event like this. The huge Indonesian earthquake on Boxing Day 2004 was an event like this. The other style of event that happens are these breaks within the subducting plate. So this isn't an earthquake between two plates. It's actually within a single plate. So it's happening. It's a break within the Pacific plate because the plate is being stretched and bent as it bends to go down into the subduction zone. So those are the two typical events. The subduction events are the more common ones, and these ones are rarer. So, and this is what we thought we'd seen in September 2009. This is just showing some locations of instrumentation that we have in the region. The red star...
John, just go ahead. Yep. It comes up at different speeds for different viewers.
Okay, so yep. I should ignore it and just describe it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the red star is the location of the earthquake, and you can see it's just to the east of this area, which the black area with the red line, which describes the Tonga Trench. The green dots are GPS stations, and these are instruments that measure ground deformation. Basically, we get a measurement every day from those green ones. The red one is a seismic station. The black dot, just to the west of the earthquake, is a what we call a campaign GPS station. So it's not a permanent, continuously operating station, but we take measurements from it every few years. So we can measure its motion by going back every few years. What we found from the continuous recording GPS sites, and there are three of them are in Samoa, one in Tonga, and one on Niue Island. And the panels on the right, the upper panel is showing the eastward displacement from about the middle of September to about the middle of October. And in the middle of the screen, on the 29th of September, you can see that there's a big change. And in the case of the red line, which is the station at Pangapango, in American Samoa, there's a change of about eight centimeters. And that's as a result of the earthquake. It's the... When the earthquake happens, there's lots of ground motion from the shaking of the earthquake waves. But when that's all over, you're left with a permanent displacement of the ground because the two sides of the fault have shifted past each other. And so you can see that there's been easterly movement and northerly movement at most of those sites. There's a couple at the bottom. The ones at the green one is at Vavao and the gray one is at Niue, which show motions in a slightly different direction. And that's because they're located in different places. So this was, if we now take those displacements and plot them on a map as arrows showing the displacement of the stations, that's the next slide. So here the yellow arrows, you can see the yellow arrows up in the Samoan Islands at the places called Fale and Samo and Aspa. Those yellow arrows are all pointing off towards the northeast. And then the black arrows are the arrows that is the amount we expect those stations to move if there had just been a normal fault, and that's shown by that beach ball symbol again, and the location of the fault is shown by the white rectangle. And so at first sight, the GPS data from these continuous GPS stations agreed quite well with the seismological data, which said it was a normal fault. If you look across to the left-hand side of the diagram, there are two sites, two of these campaign GPS sites on Niue Topitapu, which is the northernmost island of the Tonga chain. And the predicted motion of that island is down to the southwest, and that's the predicted motion from our model, which fits the other data. So that, just remember that as we go on. So this is the summary. The global seismic recordings indicated a normal fault in the outer rise, and the continuous GPS data from the Samoan and Tongan Islands are pretty much consistent with that interpretation. There was a slight inconsistency at Niue Island, which because it was so small, we initially ignored that. The other set of data that we used is data from tsunami gauges, and these are pressure gauges which are situated on the ocean floor and they're designed to detect tsunami waves as they cross the ocean above the pressure gauges. So the pressure gauge sits on the ocean floor, and there's a buoy on the surface. They're connected by a cable, and from the pressure sensor records the data, and the buoy transmits the data out, and that goes to tsunami warning centers. What we found here, that there are probably a dozen or more of these, what we call DART buoys, or ocean floor pressure gauges, across the Pacific Ocean in various places. A lot of them have been put in since the 2004 Indonesian earthquake. What we found, particularly for these two instruments, which are down in the Southwest Pacific, that the data that we observed is the black line, and you can see within the orange circles is the bit that I'm concentrating on. So within the orange circle, the black line is the observed data, and the red line is the modeled data, assuming that was just a normal fault earthquake, as was shown by the seismology, at least initially by the seismology and the GPS. And you can see that they just do not fit. The observed signal goes up first, and the model goes down first. The reason for that is, in a normal fault earthquake, the primary motion is extensional, and that means that the seafloor goes downwards initially, and that means that the water goes down, and the first wave that travels out from the tsunami is a downward wave. The opposite is the case if it's a thrust earthquake, like one on the subduction interface. In that case, the motion is compressional, and the seafloor goes up, and that pushes the water up, and so the first wave that goes out is a positive, an upward wave. And so these two DART buoys particularly were saying, hey, it's not a normal fault, it looks like a thrust fault. So the question is, what is going on? And so again, this is a repeat of that previous slide, and this time we're saying the tsunami wave observations are not consistent with a normal fault, they're more consistent with a thrust fault. And it wasn't every tsunami gauge across the Pacific that showed this, but it was particularly this group down in the Southwest Pacific. But just a reminder, the green dots are the continuous GPS stations. There's also this campaign GPS station. And there was a lot of damage on this island as a result of the tsunami. And so the Tongans were doing a lot of recovery and recovery work up there. And we asked them on one of their trips, could you go and make new measurements at these two GPS sites that we have on the island? So they went ahead and did that. And this was the result. Again, the map on the left is just reminding you where Nui Tapu Tapu is. The map on the east is showing the ground positions at these two of these two sites, and the two panels are just the two different sites. And the main thing you see there is that the east component, the eastward motion of the sites, jumps hugely between the latest set of measurements we had, which was at the end of 2006, end of 2005, and these new measurements, which were a few weeks after the earthquake, nearly 400 millimeters. It was actually more like 350 millimeters, but I just rounded it up. And so if you remember the previous slide, we'd shown that we were expecting a motion towards the southwest of about 80 millimeters, but in fact, we see this astonishing motion in completely different direction and much, much bigger, about 400 millimeters. And the clear explanation, the most obvious explanation for that is that there must have been another earthquake. So this is just showing in map view the data from that previous slide. So the yellow arrow from Nui Tapu Tapu is the observed displacement of that island, whereas the black one pointing to the southwest was what we'd expected initially. And there was another piece of evidence we looked at was what was the aftershocks from the main September earthquake. And the aftershocks are shown by all those little white circles. And you can see that most of the aftershocks aren't close to where the normal fault occurred, but they're all overlying the subduction zone, all to the west of the trench. So this was another indication that something was going on the subduction interface, not just on the normal fault. And so this is our interpretation of what happened. It wasn't just two earthquakes. It wasn't just one earthquake, but it was two earthquakes happening almost at the same time. So now you can see there are two white rectangles on the screen. One is showing the approximate area of the normal fault, the one to the right. The one to the left is showing the approximate area of the slip on the subduction interface. And the beach ball symbols are showing, the right-hand one is showing, it's got the white in the middle, and that shows that it's a normal or extensional fault. And the other one has got the black in the middle, which shows that it's a thrust fault. And so with this interpretation that there are two earthquakes, you can see that we fit all of the GPS data. The red arrows are the model with both faults included, and the yellow is the observed. You can see the red arrows and the yellow arrows agree with each other very well. And so this is a cross-sectional view of what we think is going on. There are the two earthquakes. One was the normal fault earthquake, which is actually a break within the Pacific Plate, within the upper 20 kilometers of the Pacific Plate. And the other one is the more typical subduction interface event. And in order to fit both the GPS data and the tsunami wave data, these earthquakes had to happen almost simultaneously, within about 2 minutes of each other. And this is just a very unusual occurrence. Now, looking at the Dart Buoy data from those two underwater pressure gauges, now if we include both the normal fault and the thrust fault, we find that we get a very good fit between the model and the observed, looking in those orange circles. The black lines and the red lines now pretty much follow each other. So this is showing again that it's the interpretation of two faults is consistent. The interpretation that there are two simultaneous earthquakes now fits the tsunami data as well as the GPS data. Right. So now there are a few questions here. We know that there must have been two nearly simultaneous earthquakes. And the question is why. If there was a thrust earthquake, which we see it in the tsunami data, we can tell that it happened from the GPS. Why wasn't it seen in the global seismic data? And there are two explanations for that. One was that the thrust event that between the two plates happened so slowly that it didn't efficiently generate seismic waves, but it was still fast enough that it pushed the seafloor up and generated a tsunami. And that sort of slow slip on an interface is something that we also see nearer home in New Zealand. We've seen quite a few slow slip events on subduction interfaces over the past few years. The second explanation is the normal fault happened first, the thrust fault happened very quickly afterwards, and the seismic waves between the two events got so tangled together that it wasn't immediately obvious in the global seismic recordings that there were two events. It just looked that those recordings just basically picked up the first event that happened, and then the complexity after that was too difficult to sort things out. And so here are a few finer details. We know that one of the earthquakes must have actually triggered the other in some way, because they are so close together in space and time. So it was the occurrence of the first one that caused the second one. But the thing we couldn't be certain about was which one came first. And from the data that we had available, the GPS data and the tsunami wave data in the oceans, we suspected that the subduction thrust came first, but we really couldn't be certain about it. And the second paper I referred to by the U.S. seismologists, they've taken the seismic data and really done a very, very close study on it and applied lots of different seismological techniques in order to try and unravel the fact that there were two earthquakes. And they also came to a similar conclusion as us, that there were two earthquakes in those two different locations, one within the Pacific Plate, one between the two plates. And they're pretty sure that it was the normal fault that came first, the one in the outer rise, and it was the subduction interface event that was triggered by that. By the shaking from that event. this is just the final slide with wider it's called wider implications, but I'm really only going after one implication in this instance, and there are other scientific implications as well, but this is a more widely applicable one. So the first point is that the global seismology can usually, but not always, work out the important details of a large earthquake very quickly after it happens. But there are rare cases like this one where you have to do an awful lot of detailed analysis of the seismology before the correct picture emerges. If we start to put more tsunami warning systems into operation around the world, we need to be able to actually assess rapidly the size and the mechanism of large earthquakes in order that we can predict the downstream effects of the tsunami as it crosses the ocean and impacts on coastlines. Now, most subduction zones have land on one side of them. A good example is New Zealand, the east coast of the North Island. And if we had GPS stations located on this land, and in some cases we have the GPS stations, but if their data were being continuously recorded and analyzed in pretty much in real time, then we could measure permanent ground displacements like the 350 millimeters at Niue Topotapu, and we could measure that within minutes after the occurrence of the earthquake. So the thing about the Samoa earthquake in September was that from the seismology, it looked initially just like a single normal fault event, and it took a huge amount of analysis by the seismologists to actually be able to disentangle it and say, no, there were two separate earthquakes. On the other hand, if we'd had the GPS data from Niue Taputapu available in real time, we'd have known it pretty much instantly that there'd been two earthquakes because it stands out so clearly in the GPS data. So looking ahead, it would be really good to have a combination of seismic data and GPS data to monitor effects within subduction zone regions, and therefore when a big earthquake does happen, we can make better predictions of the tsunami effects. And so that's all I'll say for now and let you guys ask questions.
Excellent. Thank you very much, John. I'm going to unmute everyone to give you all a chance to ask a question if you have any. Do we have a first question from the audience?
John, hi. It's Paul Gorman here at the Press in Christchurch.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing stuff. I'm just wondering when you say how unusual, or when you say it's a rare event and highly unusual, I mean, mm-hmm. how many others like this have sort of been observed over the years? Are there any at all?
Nothing exactly like this, no. This is the first time that we've seen one that we actually have the data to be able to disentangle it. Of course, it's very likely that similar things have happened in the past, but there hasn't been good enough, you know, seismic data and GPS data to be able to sort out what happened. About the rarity, great big earthquakes in the outer rise, like the initial normal fault earthquake, they're pretty rare themselves. I can't tell you how many happen per century, but it's not having ones that big as magnitude 8 is pretty rare. There was one of a similar magnitude in the Kuril Islands about 2 or 3 years ago, and that was pretty unusual. So they don't come along that often, and to have a pair of earthquakes, one in the subduction zone, one on the subduction interface, and one in the descending plate, to have that happen is also that's happened in the past as well. Again, it's fairly rare, and usually the separation between the two earthquakes is much longer. It's weeks or months, and typically then it's the subduction interface earthquake that happens first, and the one in the outer rise within the descending plate that happens second. So this is unique in that the two earthquakes are so close together in time and so big, and that we've actually been able to disentangle them.
Dr. Bevan, it's James here, News Talk ZB. Sorry, I may have missed this. Did you get magnitudes on those two quakes?
I think the best way to describe them is they're both about magnitude 8.0. I mean, we and the American group differ by, you know, plus or minus 0.1 in magnitude, but basically they're both magnitude 8.0 plus or minus 0.1. And the fact that our techniques, which use the GPS and the tsunami data, and their techniques, which use seismology, which are completely different techniques, and we both come up with a very, very similar result. So that's really very good confirmation of what's going on.
Putting them together, does that what type of magnitude would you say that would cause? What the effect that it would cause?
Well, when you add a magnitude 8 and a magnitude 8, you get about a magnitude 8.2, because it's not a linear scale. So it's not having two magnitude 8s together isn't that much bigger than having a magnitude. Having two magnitude 8s together is a bit worse than having one magnitude 8, but it's not hugely worse. One of the things we did was we tried to estimate the effects of the tsunami in Samoa and in northern Tonga, depending on whether there was a single earthquake or both earthquakes. And it turned out that the effects on Samoa were mainly due to the normal faulting earthquake, and that's because that earthquake was much closer to Samoa than the other one. But the effects in the northern Tonga Islands, in Niue Topatapu, would have been exacerbated, because both earthquakes, the tsunamis from both earthquakes affected that island quite severely. So it made the tsunami there worse than it would have been if there'd been only a single event.
Can you just explain briefly, when you say it's not a linear scale, you just mean that 8.2 is substantially bigger than 8.0?
Yeah,
it increases exponentially.
Yeah, 8.2 is twice as big as 8.0, pretty much. Well, 8.3 is twice as big as 8.0.
Yeah.
So it's a logarithmic scale.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of hard to get your head around sometimes. But it's a lot bigger in terms of the amount of energy that's released in the earthquake. It's not necessarily going to the effects of the earthquake aren't necessarily going to scale by the same amount.
Right. Another question?
Yeah.
John, it's Aaron Somer here from TV One News. I'd just like to know how crucial this information is, just how important the research is that's been conducted.
Oh, I think it's important.
just in terms of future proving, I guess.
Well, I think the GPS instruments that we have. Let me go back a bit. The seismic networks have been around a long time. So the system of seismic monitoring, global seismic monitoring, is fairly well established. It keeps getting improved, and the analysis techniques keep getting improved. But the GPS is actually quite new. GPS has really been around for 15 years in full scale operation, and so the opportunities that we have to use GPS data to enhance our understanding of how the Earth works, and also predict the effects of natural events like big earthquakes. We're still really at the beginning of that, and we don't have widespread, continuously operating, real-time GPS networks yet anywhere in the world, although people are certainly working on those and have been, particularly since the Indian Ocean tsunami, when it's been recognized that you need more than just seismology sometimes to be able to disentangle what's happened in an earthquake.
Thank you.
Is that good enough?
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you.
Okay, cool.
We have time for one more. Is there another question?
John, it's Karen Chuck here from the Dominion Post. Just looking at us here in New Zealand, the GPS and the seismic data that would be available to us, how well would we be able to make accurate predictions?
Well, we're doing very well on the seismic data. The GPS data at the moment, we do have quite a lot of, as part of GeoNet, we have quite a lot of GPS stations now above the subduction zone in the North Island. But most of those are still being recorded by downloading data at hourly intervals and analyzing the data once a day. So for an event like this where you want to do things in real time, it's not any good. It's good for studying the after effects. Or for understanding what happened after the event, but it's not good for actually seeing what's going on at the time. GeoNet is doing some work on upgrading some of those stations to be real-time stations, in that they will send their data back to the data center in real time, but we still have a ways to go on actually getting that data processed in real time, which is what you would need for incorporating it in a tsunami warning system. So it's, people are working on it, but it definitely needs more investment and more time put into it.
Thank you.
Great. All right, I'd like to thank all of you for joining us, and thanks especially to our speaker, Dr. John Bevan of GNS Science. We will make the slides available in our resource library, which you can log into, and also the copy of the paper, and also the additional paper that John mentioned from the U.S. team that's being published as well. If you need any follow-up information, if you'd like to get in touch with John, you can call us on 499-5476. We're happy to put you in touch. And please do remember that this is under global news embargo until 5 a.m. Tomorrow morning, Thursday, 19th August. So with that, we'll now conclude this briefing. Thank you very much.